Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, the main topic today is going to be a topic that is gaining more and more interest here, especially on the left, and that is the de-dollarization of the U.S. global economic empire, global economy, whatever you want to talk about it. You know, is the dollar on the way out as a global currency dominant? That's an interesting question, because the dollar is the linchpin of the U.S. economic global empire. As the dollar goes, so does the stress on the empire. So is this happening? Well, there are some signs of some momentum in that direction, but it's kind of hyped. A lot of it is wishful thinking more than hard economic analysis, although the trend is there. Okay, so we want to look at that topic here today in a little more detail. But first, before we get to that, I'd like to give some economic updates, some important indicators that have been coming out here, pretty much putting to bed all this talk about soft landing of the U.S. economy, and I think as well all the assumptions, false assumptions, that inflation is going to rapidly contract back to the Federal Reserve's ideal goal of 2% price increases. Okay, so let's look at some of the recent economic reports and data as to those two topics here. First of all, in the past week, we've got housing. New data on housing has come out. Existing home sales, which are about 4.4 million a year, in March contracted 2.4%. That's a big contraction for 1 month. And those sales are down 22% over the year from March to March, March 22 to March 23. So we got a big contraction going on in housing, residential housing. 13 of the last 14 months, we've seen a contraction, a further slowing. Actually, contraction, not a slowing growth, but a contraction of that activity. So very important development. And we're beginning to see now early initial signs of, in some parts of the country, of actual price declines in housing. So housing is in trouble here, has been, ever since the Fed started raising interest rates. You know, if you look back to last March of 22, that's when the rates started rising. And ever since then, housing's started declining. Okay, so housing, a very important part of the economy. I haven't been able to get the data on the commercial real estate sector, but that a lot of red flags being raised there. There's very little construction going on. They don't talk about that too much in the data. They focus on residential housing, but commercial property, real estate, we're talking about office buildings and hotels and resorts and malls and factories and so forth. We see some factory investing going on as the U.S. tries to lure tech companies back to the U.S. But office buildings are in a big funk. Most of the office buildings have not really recovered their occupancy from COVID. Now they're going to have to face refinancing their debt very soon. So we're going to see a crisis in commercial real estate, commercial property, pretty quick here, I think. Some of these owners of these office buildings are trying desperately to lure customers back, you know, giving them 6 months free rent, et cetera. but it's not having too much of an effect. Cities like New York and San Francisco are in deep trouble with that regard. Okay, so that's construction housing, not good. Continuing downward trend. Manufacturing. Let's look at manufacturing, which is about 11-12% of GDP of the economy. Manufacturing is also in the red here. Recent what's called Purchasing Managers Index reports, PMI, which indicate surveys of purchasing managers of companies. Are they reducing their purchasings or increasing them? And the index, if the number is over 50, that means more PMI managers are purchasing than those that are reducing their purchases. That's what an index does. So if the number is under 50, it means you've got a contraction going on. In February, the U.S. Purchasing Managers Index, PMI for manufacturing, there's another one for services, another one for both composite services and manufacturing, but just the manufacturing PMI in February was 47.7. In March, it fell further to 46.3, which is the lowest indicator for manufacturing PMI since May 2020, the depth of the COVID shutdown, right? We've had five continuous months now of manufacturing PMI under 50. So it's the lowest in 3 years. And within that number, 45 is a severe contraction, if you hit 45 number. 25% of the managers, PMI managers, surveyed indicated contracting of more than 45%, right? So really deep contraction in March. And that's compared to February of only 10%. So we've got a pretty important internal indicator of accelerating slowdown contraction in manufacturing because of the 45 or below figure, right? All components of PMI, all industries and so forth, are negative except for energy, oil companies, right? This is the first time that all the components of PMI have turned negative since 2009, okay? And within the PMI, new orders are particularly low. That's a future indicator of import of manufacturing contraction. Only 44.3, it's growing at 44.3 new orders, down from 47 in February. So we see this acceleration again going on in the new orders, bookings in manufacturing, and we see it in as well in the contracting more than 25% contracting of managers indicating contracting more than 45. So, you know, within this number of going from 47.7 in February to 46.3 in March, we see within it indicators that it's accelerating. Okay. Now there's an alternative PMI. I'm quoting you the traditional government PMI, but there's an alternative from S&P Global that produces a flash, in other words, a quick look for April, and that appears to be a little bit better than the numbers I've just given you. But that's a flash. It's a quick intro. And S&P Global tends to be more of a global look. That's just sort of an alternative. But the numbers are very bad for manufacturing slowdown here, just as they're very bad for housing. In other words, the goods sector, goods-producing sector, housing and manufacturing, is in a deep funk. And that's very typical of the trajectory of recessions. often it's housing, manufacturing, goods sector that contracts first because it is most sensitive to interest rates and other global demand forces. Then it spills over to the services sector afterwards. This recession is beginning to look a lot like 2001 recession, where we had that occur. 2008-09 was a financial crash that precipitated the real economic contraction that followed quickly. Right? Well, you know, there were some indicators of maybe that was going to be overlaid on this 2001 kind of trajectory with the recent banking crisis, but that's kind of stabilized a little bit here. I think the next area of financial instability, should it occur, will erupt again in the commercial real estate area or junk bonds markets for retail. Retail sector, big box retail in particular, and commercial real estate, offices and malls. You'll see quite possibly defaults there, which will then reverberate on the banks that have been supporting them, issuing these junk bonds and to keep these things, these sectors afloat over low interest rate era here, free money era, during which the banks have thrown money at zombie companies that should have gone under. But they didn't, because the money was so easy, didn't cost banks anything, and they just kept rolling over this debt and letting these zombies getting more dead. You know, I mean, companies in retail, you know, like Penny should have been out of business. We're going to see a raft of retail bankruptcies occurring here now. once they start trying to roll over that junk bond, junk loan debt here by the end of the year, they're going to be gone here, especially if interest rates continue to rise. A lot of talk about interest rate rising. Certainly now it's going to have another Fed rate hike here in May. No doubt bringing it up to about 5.25, the base policy rate here of the Fed, on which all other interest rates are based. So interest rates are going to continue to creep up. The Fed is hoping that that will deal with inflation. It hasn't been very successful so far. Inflation in the conservative indicator, the PCE, personal consumption indicator, which comes out again, that's running at 5%, and it's kind of stuck at 5%. You know, it was in the 7-8% range. Not to be confused with the consumer price index, which is a better indicator, which is higher inflation. But the PCE is what the Fed focuses on. But the Fed governor, his name is one of them, there's seven of them, his name is Waller, recently said, quote, progress on inflation has been more or less stalled, unquote. So that means the Fed's going to continue to raise rates. And how much higher it's going to raise them remains to be seen. But the higher it raises them, the more financial instability, fragility it generates. And the more likely we're going to see more problems. As I've said before in previous shows, the regional banking crisis has been with those banks associated with funding the tech sector and the crypto sector, and those two sectors went bust last year, that's part of the problem on those banks. Other forces were involved, why Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic Bank, of course. It's not just that the bubbles, which are the source of revenue for and cash flow for these banks, kind of dried up. there are other problems as well. I'm not going to go over it again. Listen to the show a couple of weeks ago. We talked about the causes of the banking crisis and why Silicon Valley Bank went under and others followed. But basically, if the interest rates keep rising, which now will happen because, as Waller said, progress has been stalled with interest rates at 5%, so you're going to see higher rates. We'll see how much higher. Depends on the next reports this spring on inflation. Talking about inflation, food prices. You know, I've been arguing that a lot of the U.S. inflation has to do with monopolistic corporations price gouging, making up for the lack of revenue and profits during COVID, recouping those at the expense of the consumer. There are other supply-side causes of inflation. I'm not going to go over that again. We've treated that in a show in the past. Take a look. Mostly supply side. Fed can only address demand side, et cetera. But if you look at food prices, a lot of that is corporate price gouging. Even the more conservative PCE indicator shows that food prices were up over the past year 8.5%. Food prices, 8.5%, as opposed to the PCE's average for everything of 5% year to year. So food prices are up, 150, 170% more than the general price increase. Now, my argument that it's price gouging is supported by the fact that the data shows 97% of food corporations, that was processing food and so forth, 97% of these corporations had record revenue increases last year, virtually totally from price increases, not from selling more. It changes very little how much people increase the demand for food. That changes very slowly. But if profits go up to a record level, which they did, 97% food corp revenue up, all from price increases, 80% of those food corporations record profits last year. In other words, all these revenue and profit numbers are all from price hikes. That's price gouging. That's price gouging because they are monopolistic. It's like 3, 4, 5 companies dominating each of these areas of food processing. Chickens and eggs and dairy products and so forth, distributors, processed food of all kinds. Farm prices, by the way, are down. Farm prices are down, but prices like for soft drinks, beverages, cereals, bakery goods, and so forth, in other words, where the monopolistic corporations play, are up record levels, but the costs are down. Their costs are down, but at least their actual commodity costs, I'm not talking about their processing costs and their distributing costs, but the profits are way up and farmers are getting less. Okay. Now, last month in March, food prices for the first time in quite some time actually reduced by 0.3%. But if you look at it, almost totally due to egg prices, which were through the roof, doubling, now contracting again a little bit, down 11%, and spring vegetables and fruits. Right, that's why you had last month, the first time in a while, actual food prices coming down a little bit. But the monopolistic sector food prices are continuing to rise. Soft drinks, cereals, et cetera. Okay, so that's the picture with inflation. Latest data confirming my argument. A lot of price gouging going on by monopolistic corporations in the U.S. including, of course, the oil companies, where now gasoline prices are starting to rise again, as I predicted, for multiple reasons. One, crude oil prices are rising $80, $85 a barrel now because of the price cuts by OPEC. I mean, production cuts by OPEC. And, of course, that's being transferred to the consumers here in the U.S., even though the U.S. is sitting on a glut of oil in the ground. And it's spring, so now you've got maintenance going on in these refineries, which haven't been built in the U.S. There's a refinery shortage. That's the bottleneck that the oil companies use when, you know, they just shut down for maintenance a couple of refineries, or, quote, they have a fire. You know, they use that as an excuse. Well, they got fires in those refineries all the time. But those are excuses to raise gasoline prices in the spring. And they're going up again. Here in Northern California, prices are approaching $6 a gallon again. They're like upper over $5.50 a gallon. So that's occurring once again. As I predicted, it would. Price gouging continuing. And gasoline prices rising again, food prices when the monopolistic processors chronically higher. Restaurant prices, of course, rising. We'll see a lot of restaurants go out of business because the cost of eating out is getting so high. Except, of course, if you want to buy a burger or fried chicken, that's not rising the way, but your typical regional chain restaurants and higher end restaurants, you know, it's incredible to go out and eat, and people are pulling back from that. They can't afford that. Okay, the last economic update is the leading economic indicators, which kind of tell you, you know, classic indicator, the LEI, leading economic indicators, the direction of the economy. In March, the LEI down a negative 1.2% again, the lowest since November 2020. Now, year on year, March to March, the leading economic indicators are down 7.8%. That level, last seen in the 1981 recession. So, pretty strong LEI indicating we're in a deeper recession, especially when you add on top of it what I previously talked about with housing and manufacturing and inflation, which is going to mean higher interest rates still, and slowing global economy, according to the IMF. So all the indicators are flashing red, and all this happy talk in mainstream media about, oh, soft landing, we're going to make a soft landing, is just nonsense. You know, it's coming from sources that have to provide that happy talk, because if they didn't, they would panic the economy, businesses, and so forth, and make it even worse, so they don't. I'm talking about Biden administration spokespersons on the economy, you know, Council of Economic Advisors, all that stuff. Yeah. We will also see in about a week or so, I think, the Fed's, what's it called? It's called the lending officers, bank lending officers survey of lending officers. In other words, is bank lending increasing or contracting, and how much is it contracting? Of course, higher interest rates cause it to contract, but also the fear of the banking crisis is also overlaid on that, and is going to impact bank lending. We just don't know how much yet from the March banking crisis eruption that's occurred. We'll begin to see how much that's impact on bank lending and therefore business investment here in a couple more weeks. how serious the impact of that has been. And then, of course, there's the earnings season in the stock market. If businesses aren't earning, if they're contracting or, you know, hardly making any money, that means less investment, too, and less economic activity. Nevertheless, mainstream media is predicting GDP this year annualized at 2%. We'll see where that goes here over the spring and summer. Okay, so that's the update. That's the update. Now I want to get into this question of the de-dollarization of the global economy. As I said earlier and before, the dollar is the linchpin of the global economic empire. If the dollar, the use of the dollar declines, then it sets in motion all kinds of problems for the U.S. domestic economy. Right? It exacerbates the trade deficit. Well, let me get to those effects here at the end of the sort of a presentation here on the de-dollarization. On the left, there's a lot of hyping of, oh, the dollar is doomed. And, you know, the Chinese yuan, or the international version of the Chinese yuan called the renminbi, but I'll just use the word yuan, Y-U-A-N, yuan. You pronounce it yuan, not yuan, it's yuan. Okay, so the left is predicting that, you know, the dollar is doomed and that its demise is... well, it's true, I agree, that the momentum is towards the decline of the dollar, very clearly. But it's nowhere near the crisis stage that wishful thinking on the left kind of decides, right? When you talk about the dollar as the global currency, you need to distinguish between the dollar being used for trading, in other words, buying and selling goods, commodities, etc. And that varies by commodity, by good, how much is used for dollars, and how much is maybe occurring in other currencies. For example, within Europe, the buying and selling of goods trading, the euro is preeminent because you've got this euro region here. So all of that trade, which is fairly significant in volume, is in euro. Right? The euro outside of the eurozone is not used as much as with inside the eurozone. Okay, so the dollar is a trading currency. In other words, transactions, buying and selling goods and services is one thing, but then there's the dollar as the global reserve currency, or anchor currency, you might say. You know, all money is used for transactions, regardless of what it is, whether it's a currency, whether it's, you know, a gold or silver money. It has two functions. One is at least one is for transactions, and the other is for store value. In other words, just held as a reserve currency. In other words, central banks using it as a reserve in their portfolios. So the dollar is a reserve currency. The dollar is a trading currency. You know, is it declining in either or both areas? Right. And that has to do with demand, excuse me, and supply for the dollar, both to trade and both to hold as a reserve. Okay, so what causes changes in the demand for the dollar? Well, the demand for the dollar goes up for a number of reasons in the short run. for example, right? If U.S. interest rates are rising, then U.S. Treasury rates are rising, right? And they're a nice, safe investment, a haven, right? And if you are an investor offshore or a U.S. corporation offshore or any kind of company offshore or investor offshore, then you may want to hold dollars because interest rates are rising. Invest in U.S. Treasuries. Well, to buy U.S. Treasuries, you have to buy them in, you have to get dollars to buy them. You can't buy them with Argentine pesos. No, you got to use your pesos to buy dollars in global dollar markets to then buy the treasuries. So as interest rates rise, the dollar rises because the demand for the dollar increases. So in the short run, the dollar increases in value and importance for that particular reason. Slowing economic growth outside the U.S. You know, if I'm an investor outside the U.S. and my economy's in recession, I'm losing money. My stocks, stock market investments are declining, right? People aren't buying the goods and the companies I invested in. Their stock prices are falling. I don't want to hold my local currency because the global economy is declining. I want to put it somewhere where it's safer, and that's usually in dollars or investments in the U.S., treasuries, whatever. So I'm going to take my currencies, get them out of wherever I've invested them locally, and invest in the U.S., either in treasuries or some other assets in the U.S., private assets. So the demand for dollars is going to increase for that reason, too. And in the short run, that means, you know, the dollar is not declining, it's rising. In the short run, we got to emphasize that, right? Fed rate hikes in the U.S. depress local currencies. Fed rate hikes raise the value of the dollar, causes local currencies to decline, to devalue. I want to, if I'm an investor or a business, I want to get out of the local currencies. And that means the demand for dollars, right? Also, when you've got rising costs of oil and commodities, industrial commodities, agricultural commodities, because of sanctions, right? That's another reason that you may have to buy dollars if you want to continue to buy oil or industrial commodities, you know, metals or even agricultural goods, wheat, corn, whatever. Because these commodities are only bought and sold in dollars until recently, right? So if the oil companies and commodity companies or raw materials are raising the price of their commodities, well, then you as a country or an investor have to get more dollars somehow. And your dollar, your currencies are declining now, remember? Mm-hmm. So somehow you got to get more dollars if you want to keep the import flow of those key commodities in oil and energy. In other words, the sanctions, the U.S. sanctions there with Ukraine and the war are causing all things equal, other forces there determining the price of oil, driving up the price of oil because they're creating a supply problem and therefore the demand for dollars to buy these things. It also means longer term that people, countries, investors want to get the hell out of the dollar for buying these commodities. They're at the mercy of the U.S. Policies, whether it's monetary policies or political policies, their economies and their standard of living is at the mercy, just because the dollar is the trading currency for virtually all oil and commodities. Right. Okay. And central banks, well, before I talk about central banks' role here, foreign exchange. You know, you've got a lot of speculators, global speculators, finance capitalists who buy and sell currencies. And they love it when the dollar goes up, right? They make money on the dollar appreciation. And they can even make money by shorting the value of currencies of other countries. So as the demand for dollars and the value of dollar goes up, speculation in dollars and other currencies increases as well, and that increases the demand for dollars even more. And then central banks hold dollars as reserves as well. But that's been declining, you see. That's been declining. Central banks kind of peaked in holding dollars as reserves on their books here by 2010. They increased significantly in the 1990s as the U.S. began its global financialization policies here. And it peaked in the 2010s. Now it's declining because China is pulling out of holding dollars and holding U.S. treasuries. It used to be well over $1 trillion, $1.1 trillion in reserves, dollar, near dollar assets. Now they've been consistently, I would say, dumping the dollars, but not slowly letting them roll off here, and they're about $900 billion they hold in dollars, in dollar-denominated securities here. I think there's some evidence of Japan slowing as well. Japan now is the biggest holder of U.S. dollars, I think $1.2 trillion or something. And China, which used to be, is now definitely less. Okay, so the sanctions on energy and commodities coming out of Russia, right, are pushing emerging market economies toward trying to find some alternative to using the dollar. There's talk about using the, and in some fact, using the China yuan. I think Saudi Arabia and China just agreed to buy and sell oil using the yuan here. Big, big move, big development here, and a big factor harboring the decline of the dollar. Right? So there's more move towards using local currencies and countries buying and selling between themselves using currencies, like Brazil will sell its oil to China now in exchange for China yuan, and then we'll use that yuan to buy China products. So currency-to-currency transactions using their own national currencies, using the yuan, using gold, the BRICS, as the BRICS trading area expands, the BRICS are this trading agreement between Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, which is now expanding. The BRICS are going to expand significantly. Probably, well, certainly Argentina has announced, there's rumors Mexico is going to join even, and Turkey, and maybe Egypt, and who knows what other countries. But very clearly, the China BRICS alternative to the U.S. global trading empire is getting stronger. And when that happens, those countries is more likely they're going to use a currency, a new currency, a new trading currency, probably, you know, supported by a basket of currencies, or maybe even gold-backed currencies. So that's going to happen here soon, and that's all an indicator of the decline of the dollar, because they're not going to use the dollar. The demand for the dollar is going to decline, If the demand for the dollar declines, then the value of the dollar will decline. And there are consequences to that, which we'll talk about. Okay? So even though in the short run, the U.S. keeps playing its game of raising rates and causing recessions and treasuries, and you know, which all in has control still of a lot of the oil and commodities. Central banks hold dollars. All that stuff is going on in the short run. In the longer run, we've got these trends, geopolitical and geoeconomic trends, that portend less use of the dollar, less demand for the dollar. You know, the short-run examples I gave you all result in a rising demand for the dollar. But longer term, because of these changes, driven largely by the sanctions and the war, the U.S. policy about sanctions and the war, in order to achieve its geopolitical objectives of pushing NATO east and pushing Russia, you know, into instability, economic, political, and their objective here. to attain those objectives, geopolitical NATO objectives, they're shooting themselves in the foot on the global economic empire, the stability of their global economic empire. That's the trade-off. That's the cost. They are, wars accelerate developments already underway. And we're seeing this with accelerating the move away from the dollar and an alternative trading block here based upon expanded BRICS and new currencies. And you'll see as well a decline of the other instrument of the U.S. global economic hegemony called the SWIFT. That's an acronym, S-W-I-F-T, International Payment System, which goes along with the dollar, which allows the U.S. to see who is violating the sanctions, you know? So if you want to get out from the U.S. saying, oh, you're buying Russian oil, you just buy it in other than dollars. It never goes through American banks, which inform the government of what's going on. And that's another reason that you're going to see an acceleration of use of alternative currencies going on. The price of the dollar, the value of the dollar, is also determined to some extent by supply forces, mostly demand, but some supply forces. You know, is the U.S. continuing to push out dollars into the global economy? And that, of course, is continuing as long as the U.S. runs the trade deficit. It means more net outflow of dollars than inflow of dollars. And then whenever there's a financial crisis, the Fed throws dollars at other central banks. These are called currency swaps. That increases dollars. U.S. corporations investing abroad, foreign direct investment, that increases the flow of dollars offshore. But whenever there's a continuing trade deficit, that means dollar outflows into the global economy. And, of course, simple supply and demand means more supply of something means the price comes down. Right? So you're going to have declining demand for the dollars bringing the value of the dollar down. And you can have increasing supply of dollars bringing the value of the dollar down. And both trends are on the agenda here that we're going to see. And if the dollar declines in value because more countries aren't using it, that's going to have major consequences, one of which, of course, is these countries are not going to recycle the dollars that have been flowing out and continue to flow out because of trade deficit and foreign direct investment deficit into the world economy. The U.S. has been running a trade deficit since the early 1980s. You see, the purposeful, planned running of a trade deficit is part of the whole neoliberal capitalist restructuring that began in the late 70s, early 80s. The U.S. land and accepts a trade deficit. Why would it do that? Why would it have a deficit where plan a deficit where dollars are flowing into the global economy? Oh, well, because at the same time, as part of neoliberalism, the policy was to incentivize and allow U.S. corporations to move offshore, deindustrialization, right? Move them offshore, greater profits offshore. Well, you got to have the dollars flowing offshore, you know, to invest and expand. Dollars followed the capitalist expansion, U.S. capital expansion offshore. Once these companies were offshore, of course, they recycle those dollars back to the U.S., as do the non-U.S. corporations and governments and so forth. The whole understanding of free trade, another linked policy here, is that the dollars accumulating offshore will be recycled back to the U.S. to buy treasuries, treasury bonds, right? The holders of dollars, excess dollars, will recycle them back to the U.S. You could see it in China. That's how China and Japan end up with $1 trillion in reserves, because they accumulate in their central banks, and then those central banks buy U.S. treasuries. The dollars come back. Now, this is called the twin deficit solution of neoliberalism. You know, if you are running a trade deficit and you are recycling those excess dollars back to the U.S., buying treasuries, well, then the U.S. budget can run in a deeper deficit because the money's coming back to the treasury. And if you run a deeper budget deficit, what does that mean? Well, that means you can cut corporate taxes and you can spend money on wars. So the budget deficit is chronic and planned as well. It is the flip side of the trade deficit. And this is part of the capitalist plan for U.S. capitalists for expanding and increasing its hegemony abroad, which has been underway since the 1980s, which was the solution to the 1970s crisis, economic crisis. The twin deficit solution is key to the U.S. global economic empire. But now, if the dollar declines in value, that's going to upset that whole process. And ultimately, it means dollars won't flow back as much, and you can't run as big a budget deficit as you did. Now, the capitalists, that budget deficit is due largely because of the war spending, the Pentagon war spending in the last 20 years, $7 trillion, and tax cuts for corporations and the rich since 2001, $15 trillion. That's $22 trillion from war and tax cuts. Tax revenues, because tax cuts are slow growth, accounts for 60% of the budget deficit and therefore the debt. So that's the part that's planned. What wasn't planned is the crash of 2008-09 and the bailout. You know, about $1 trillion spent on bailing out the economy by Congress, $4 trillion spent by the Fed. But $1 trillion, the Fed debt does not enter into the calculation of the U.S. National debt. That's a separate debt pile. If you get $22 trillion over the last two decades due to war spending, Pentagon spending, war spending, which is over $1 trillion a year, all inputs, not just Pentagon, $7 trillion on these wasted wars, $15 trillion on tax cuts for corporations and rich and 1%, $22 trillion. But overlaid on that are the deficit spending because of the crises, the two deep contractions we've had, one 2008-09 crash, and then the COVID 2021 crash. You know, the government, Congress had to spend trillions of dollars, about $1 trillion on the first one and $2 or $3 trillion on the COVID one. So that adds to the deficit and debt as well. So part of this deficit and debt they plan and they, you know, don't have any problem with, but the other part has come up because of instability of the system, and that's overlaid on the $22 trillion. Okay. But that all gets upset if the value of the dollar crashes. If the demand and the use of the dollar globally declines because alternative currencies and trading arrangements rise because of the sanctions, because of U.S. neocon geopolitical objectives. You see the thread and the interrelationship between politics and economics here on a global scale. The U.S. capitalists are weakening their global economic hegemony and their empire because of their political objectives going on in Europe, which is a precursor to their plans to go after China. China's the real target, but they've decided, well, we got to neutralize Russia first. And besides, if we can do that and put Russia on its knees, you know, they got a lot of nice, cheap natural resources that we'd like to get our hands on. Okay, let's get back to the dollar. But the dollar is at the center of all this, right? I mean, look at it. Look at the way that the finance imperialism works. The first thing it works, it tries to undermine the currency of the country by initially preventing it from obtaining dollars that it needs for imports. And if it wants to buy oil and commodities and so forth, right? Or semiconductor chips and military supplies, whatever, right? Deny the country access to dollars. Critical. That's what they tried to do with Venezuela to some success, but they never broke it. Squeeze it. Don't allow it to sell its oil to earn dollars, right? Don't allow it to have its company Citgo in the U.S. that sold oil in the U.S. just grab it like a pirate, take it from Venezuela, deny it access to dollars, right? If you don't have dollars, then you can't buy other commodities that you need, including medical and food imports, right? Causes destabilization. Well, the country then pumps more, creates an excess of its own currency, the bolivar, which destabilizes it, its local economy inflation-wise as well. So you see how it works. The dollar is the big weapon that when the U.S. wants to squeeze a country, it just does what it tried to do with Venezuela. But it's a different question going after a big country with a lot of their own resources, doesn't need oil or commodities like Russia. That's a different thing. They thought, though, that they can do the same thing, that the sanctions and denying Russia of dollars, prevent Russia getting access to Western banks and markets, deny it dollars, right? Get U.S. and other European companies to leave Russia while they were bringing dollars into Russia, right? Seize Russia's store of gold and other dollars around the world, $300 billion, I'll deny them dollars and currencies and assets. It was all designed to do that, but it hasn't worked. Russia's economy hasn't worked because Russia simply responded by selling even more oil at a cheaper discounted price that countries like India and others could not resist, the cheap Russian oil, and they bought it. So Russian oil volume and value of exports did not decline. Its currency did not decline. Initially, it sort of fell, but it's recovered, Russian ruble. There's no indications that the U.S. policies have been successful in sanctions against Russia. They have been successful in driving Russia out of Western Europe so that U.S. corporations can come in and charge the Europeans even more. I mean, Europe's become an economic vassalage of the United States. There's no independent Europe anymore, even politically, at least among the elites. I mean, that's obvious now. Anyway, I don't want to get too much into the Ukraine and the war and so forth. We talked about that before, but it is tied into this whole dollar thing because the U.S. is trying to prevent access to dollars by Russia and access to other markets. And it's it's a harbinger of things. It's already slowly beginning to do with regard to China. And that's why these countries, Russia, China, and others, are now blocking together. And one of the things they're doing is moving towards an independent currency for buying commodities and oil, for example, and other goods, and developing an independent international payment system, alternative to the SWIFT, and even talking about an alternative to the IMF and World Bank. By the way, you know, the IMF, in its mission statement, says it cannot loan to countries that are at war. Well, it just broke that rule here and gave $15 billion to Ukraine. The IMF is run by the U.S. It provides the most money, so its board is really heavily weighted to the U.S. and U.S. allies. So the U.S. determines who gets to run these institutions of the U.S. economic empire, the IMF and the World Bank, and the SWIFT, international payment system, and the dollar. You see, this is the four legs of the U.S. financial imperialism and its economic power around the world, which is declining to the extent that countries break out of the dollar system and the SWIFT system and the IMF system. And that's the longer term trend. We can see that. But it's a longer term trend. It's not happening overnight. Okay, there is a report that just came out by Congressional Budget Office annual in this April called, quote, "The U.S. dollar is an international currency and its economic effects," unquote, right? Just to give some quick statistics before we leave here from this report, 80% of the dollar was 80% of global reserve currency, right? It replaced the British pound in the 1950s. The 1970s, it was 80%. In the 2020s today, it is still 60%. And a lot of that decline is due to, internally within Europe, the European Eurozone here is part of that decline. Right, but also the yuan, the Chinese yuan as reserve currency, is increasing, and 1/4 of the decline from 80% to 60% is due to the shift to the yuan. Other local currencies are being used more so in local trade here. Right, 60%. Okay, so 60% dollars of U.S. trading and reserve currency. Okay, we'll talk about this report more next week. I'm out of here.